Very well then. To reiterate, over the first 3 months of this year, we're doing this Dharma talk and discussion series on what the Buddha called the three characteristics or the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And these are rather sort of seminal teachings in Buddha Dharma. This was sort of his starting point. Insofar as trying to offer his insights, his wisdom, into what he discovered through personal inquiry, into the nature of dissatisfaction and stress, as it sometimes, dukkha, you know, why we suffer, okay. Particularly the kind of suffering that seems to be self-induced, that seems to actually be generated by the mind itself. What the nature of that distress or that unsatisfactoriness is, where it comes from, how it's generated, and how through a certain amount of effort and insight, it can be brought to an end. So to become well-grounded in this realm of teaching where the Buddha started, it's beneficial to really inquire a little more deeply into each of these three concepts. So we did two on anicca, on ceaseless change. This is the second of two on anatta, or not-self. And then later this month and in March, we're going to be inquiring into the nature of dukkha. So to recap, when the Buddha began to teach, what he was offering, based upon his own experience, his own insights, was very much at odds with the kind of the dominant understanding of the time in terms of the nature of human spirituality. He was born into a Hindu country. And Hinduism, not unlike other theistic traditions, Christianity and Judaism and whatnot, posited the existence of a kind of an omniscient oversoul, or God, right? And likewise posited the existence of a soul, or divine self. And certainly in Hinduism, the goal was to, through self-purification, achieve unity between the Godhead, between Brahma, and between one's divine nature, okay, Atman. Buddha, being quite the empiricist, inquiring into this, the nature of the functioning of his own mind, his understanding of what he saw around him, when he began to teach, among the more revolutionary things he had to say, both for his time and ours, well, you know, based upon my own investigation, my own observation, I didn't find either of those things to be true. Okay. Neither an omniscient oversoul that is creation, then it is the consciousness of creation, nor a permanent and abiding self. So his term for that was not self, anatma. And so this teaching is anatta, the Buddha's teachings on not self. Okay. Well, if there's not a permanent and abiding self, he was asked, what is there? And what he said there is instead is a very rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes. And that which we call self, he said, is nothing more than the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay. The Pali word for aggregate is skanda. The root meaning of that word is and he was always using, trying to find terms that the people he was talking to in an agrarian society could relate to. And so he used this image of a granary, okay? A granary to which somebody who was, you know, like if it was on a great estate or something, and one of the people on the kitchen staff would go to the granary and take out certain measures of the different grains they stored there. Millet or wheat or rice or whatever. So it's just this idea of these heaps of infinite particles of different kinds that then would be mixed together as ingredients, and you'd come up with, you know, the evening's entree. Okay. So these five ingredients of self that the Buddha talked about, one was the very existence of the body, name and form, with its ability to process sensory input, take in information from the environment, okay. Quickly judge it to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, okay. That's the second skanda, that's the second mental function. And we're talking about these things all happening in fractions of a second, right? First, the body's just there with its sensory apparatus waiting to take in information about the environment. Second, there's a stimulus. The mind immediately judges it to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then right after that, it searches through the memory banks to identify it. What is it? What is it I just heard? The sound of something falling on the floor, the sound of children playing downstairs, right? So you start off with just the raw data, the sensory input. Then the mind quickly processes it, says, okay, what is it? I've got to give it a name, all right? And then the next thing that happens is that the sensory input and the perception, the identification of it, and oftentimes is related to a fourth area, okay? And the Pali word for this fourth skanda, this fourth aggregate, is called the sankharas. It's usually translated as mental factors, but it's kind of a term that's, you know, I've found identified and used in many ways, simply within the Pali canon and certainly elsewhere in the Buddha Dharmas. And essentially it seems to consist of basically our entire life's history, among other things. Everything that ever happened to us, or everything we ever did in our lives that made some kind of impression, that the mind thought that for whatever reason was worth hanging on to, is in there. Memories, reflections, wholesome and unwholesome emotions, wholesome and unwholesome intentions, volition, okay? All these things reside in this sort of grand memory bank, the sankharas. In the Mahayana tradition, this is referred to as seed consciousness. The idea basically being that kind of like a seed bed in a nursery, all of these phenomena are there. Okay. One of my own teachers, the monk Ajahn Amaro, talks about all of these sankharas as being what he called potentially existent, right? They're residing kind of in the unconscious, just sort of hanging out. But when there is some requisite stimulus, all of a sudden they come into being. Okay. Fifth of the five aggregates, okay, is consciousness. Consciousness is a neutral thing. It's certain under. This use of the word consciousness with regard to the sangha, skandhas, it's kind of like the security camera. It's just kind of perched up there watching everything that's going on. It's aware of the fact that the senses are registering information. It's aware of the fact that the information is being judged, the stimulus is being judged, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, the vedana. It's aware of the mind's identifying it as what it is. And then it's also aware of the mind then trolling around the sankharas to contextualize whatever it is that's just been identified. Okay. Among the most important of the sankharas are these things hanging out in the seedbed that's discussed in the texts and in the modern commentaries as well, is this quality of the mind that's usually referred to as volition, okay? or intention. It's one of the seeds hanging out in the seedbed. So, you know, in trying to think about ways to characterize that, I tend to rely first on my personal experience. And one of the things that I that happened for me over the course of the winter holidays, my mind, for some reason, you know, my mind-body process, you know, I grew up in southern Arizona in the Sonoran Desert, you know, I am firmly convinced that the winters here in Colorado were trying to kill me. And that as a result, I need to do everything I possibly can every fall to keep that from happening. And so starting somewhere around the holidays, I find that I have this growing tendency to consume everything in sight in copious quantities. Which I did this last holiday, you know, first here at home and then visiting friends in the Bay Area and then off to Hawaii where I immediately ceased all my good intentions as far as lots of exercise and whatnot went out the window, but I certainly didn't cut back on the consumption end of things. With the result that I gained quite a lot of weight in a very short period of time. Got back home and realized that I was really doing myself no good at all. And that the time had come to actually try to do something systematic about my tendency toward overconsumption. As I looked at what was going on, what I found that actually be happening in my own consciousness is the unwholesome qualities of mind that hang out in the seedbed that the Buddha said are basically the root of all suffering. Attachment, aversion, and delusion. The senses were very attached to sense gratification. Okay? Gobbling up everything in sight whenever there was the opportunity. Okay? Whenever I would actually kind of sit with this and try to look at what was going on, gain some insight into why I seemed to be kind of out of control with my consumption, okay? I could see the attachment, the greed, you know, the wanting to gratify the senses at every opportunity. But what I was also able to get in touch with, which was another motivation behind all this, which was fear. You know, there really was something going on at kind of a primal level. You know, I noticed that I overconsume the most the colder it is, right? And that goes along with this sort of seasonal affective disorder I get every fall anyway. And so there was that element. The delusion was my consuming like crazy, detached from the actual knowledge of what it was doing to my body. So when I decided that it was really time to do something, and my wife heartily agreed, and decided that maybe it was time for her to rein it in a little bit too, we joined a weight control program together. One that uses applications to keep track of everything you eat throughout the day and what its food value is or is not and what it's doing to your body. And so we began to do that. It was like, you know, your little insight NSA gathering intelligence on your consumption, right? So we both began to do that quite religiously, you know. And so one of the real beneficial functions of getting into this program and taking this approach was really all about mindfulness, and it was about dispelling illusion. Okay? Because what it was doing, you know, this application was telling me exactly what the effects were of everything I was consuming. Okay? The Buddha's teachings on karma are about cause and effect. Okay? And you do this, and this is going to be the outcome. And so I started just keeping track of everything I ate, you know, over the course of the day. And it quickly became apparent why I was continuing to gain weight, or at the very least not losing any. So first came just, you know, the part about just sort of keeping track. As I would look at the relationship between what I was eating and the effect it was having, Gradually, little bit by little bit by little bit, it began to influence volition, which is to say, instead of just writing down the effect that something I'd eaten was having on me after the fact, I began to reflect before I ate something of what the likely effects of doing so were going to be. So I crossed over into being able to reflect on intention prior to action. That's exactly what we do when we're doing mindfulness meditation, right? We're trying to attune the mind to the point where we are able to apprehend, have some insight into what are the likely consequences of saying or doing a certain thing. Are they likely to have beneficial consequences or unwholesome ones? So I did this program for a couple of weeks, and you go in, you weigh in to see if you've lost any weight or not, right? So I weigh in, and after 2 weeks' time, I've lost like about a pound and a half or 2 pounds, right? And I became really morose and self-pitying. You know, I said, I've been trying so hard, I've been so hungry all this time, and big whoop, you know, pound a week, right? And I was just in a kind of a funky mood that day anyway. What I went out and did right after this noon meeting was go to a locally owned hamburger joint, and I had a nice big hamburger and a full order of fries. Yeah. It was like, and then you taste great, you know. I got home and then I kind of started reflecting on what I did, and I'm just like, well, okay, it looks like probably what I was doing there was taking vengeance on myself for not having lost more weight, right? The effect being, of course, the next time I weighed in, I gained the weight back, you know, which simply meant that I had to start over. And go through the whole, essentially, you know, it's fun while it lasted, but all it really did was prolong the agony, right? In terms of, you know, reasserting myself to my goal and getting back in the saddle again and plodding on down the trail. So now, at least, when I feel hunger arise, you know, the sensation of hunger, right? One of the things I'm playing with right now in terms of the Vedanas is trying, you know, and my tendency, my habit of mind, is always to judge hunger as unpleasant, as something that you need to do something about. Okay. So at least now, sometimes, I've begun to play with this idea of hunger as not necessarily being unpleasant. It's like saying, okay, what's going on when you feel hungry is that the body is beginning to consume itself. Which is basically what you want, right? And if indeed that's what you want, you know, if you want to start chipping away at all this weight that I don't want to be carrying around anymore, then that's all that sensation is telling you. Well, it works up to a point. And then when it doesn't work anymore, say, okay, well, I'm hungry, noting, hunger, 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 they go on for a couple, 3 hours, I'm gonna do something about it. And then comes, you know, the arising of intention. Okay. So at first when I feel a sensation of hunger, identify it as hunger, and then I would notice the tendency of mind, oh, I want to do something about it, is sit with that and say, okay, is this really unpleasant? Can I just sit with being hungry without doing anything about it? So that is reflection on intention, the intention to do nothing, right? And at some point, when I say, all right, enough already, I'm going to do something about it, okay, that's another arising of intention in the mind, okay, the intention to do something about the fact that I'm hungry. Then comes reflection on what it is I'm going to eat. Okay. So, my default option in the past had nearly always been a bowl of Rocky Road ice cream. little insight into, you know, the situation I found myself in. So I said, okay, well, that's one of my traditional, you know, one of the places the mind automatically goes, one of the intentions that arises. What about instead if I had some fruit with a little bit of yogurt on top instead? So I find myself at a crossroads of intentions. One of which is undoubtedly, at least my little counter app tells me, is a good deal more virtuous than the other. So here's this decision stream of intentions, okay? The arising of the sensation of hunger, the trying to figure out whether or not to do anything about it, okay? And for a while, exerting volition to do nothing about it, to just be hungry. Then later on saying, okay, there now arises the intention to do something about it. Okay, what am I going to do about it? Okay. And then comes this opportunity to reflect on the likely consequences of alternative forms of action. That is exactly what's going on when we do mindfulness meditation. The icon of the Dharma Chakra, the Dharma Wheel, as we know, is symbolic of the Eightfold Path, which is the Buddha's teachings on how to bring suffering to an end. Okay. It's divided up into three sections. Okay. One called the meditative factors, or samadhi. Second is called the wisdom factors, or panya, is the Pali word for it. And then the third section is sort of virtuous life in the world. You know, literally, one literal translation is living in harmony with, okay, in terms of one's speech, action, and way of life. So in this way of thinking about things, about applying the Buddha's teachings, we undertake the meditative practices, developing the three qualities of effort, of concentration, and of mindfulness. The ability to see clearly. Okay. Once the mind is mindful, is aware, is able to see clearly what is going on, what's coming up, okay, then as you move around the wheel, you move into the wisdom factors. What happens when you encounter the first of the wisdom factors or cultivate it is that the quality of mindfulness is combined with, like ingredients in a dish, is combined with knowledge of Buddha Dharma, knowledge of things like the three marks of existence, frameworks, ways of thinking about what's going on in the mind, knowledge of anicca, knowledge of anatta, knowledge of dukkha, as the Buddha taught these things. And remember, he didn't teach them as gospel. He said, abide contemplating the possibility that these things are true. What these things are concepts, ideas, constructs, tools for your Dharma toolkit. Okay. So try experimenting with applying these teachings, framing what comes up in your mindfulness practice within this framework. Okay. Vinicca, anatta, dukkha. When you do that, when you remain mindful and aware, stable mind, you inquire into the nature of these teachings, what happens for some people is as they look at the teachings and as they evaluate, reflect on their own experience, what comes up in the mind, there's a felt sense of resonance, of feeling like, you know, I think the guy may have been right. It makes sense to me, you know, it's helpful for me to be able to reflect on my own experience, gain self-knowledge, okay, by applying these teachings to my own experience. If indeed you have the experience of these teachings being validated by what actually goes on in your mind, that it helps you to understand what's happening, okay, then you are developing the first of the wisdom factors. It's called right or wise understanding. It's not just knowledge of the Dharma as a doctrine. It's insight into, it's an understanding that, yeah, I think that's what's going on in my own mind. Okay. that's also where you are able to gain more insight into, get better at identifying the nature of the sankharas. Sometimes they're, especially in Zen, the sankharas are characterized as like a seabed, the alaya, okay, that then all you're doing when you're doing mindfulness meditation practice of all these seeds in the bed that are maybe being watered and nourished, they begin to sprout and come up, and as they do, they begin to exhibit certain characteristics, identifying characteristics, like how you identify a plant or something. And as they do that, if you're just sitting there mindfully watching these sankharas arise in the mind, thoughts, feelings, memories, maybe feelings of aversion or ill will, feelings of anxiety or fear, feelings of loving kindness, feelings of compassion, then you begin to be better able to recognize them for what they are. As you become better able to recognize what it is that's arising in the mind, that's exactly what's going on with the first of the wisdom factors, right understanding or right view, really coming into a deep, insightful understanding of who you are in the deepest sense, right? What it is that's constituting yourself, you know, at any given point in time. And you begin to understand the nature of what the Buddha called I-making and me-making, how the mind is constructing the self at any given point in time. So he says, it's this, it's like the skandhas, you know, like in a recipe. The skandhas are the ingredients, and the cooking instructions, okay, are another realm of teachings called paticca samuppada in Pali, or dependent origination. It's the actual process by which you mix all this stuff together and you put in the sauce and the thickening, and voila, you know, and you've got a meal and you walk. As you get better and better at identifying the ingredients that are going into the wok and examining how it is they're coming together, okay, then if some of the ingredients that it looks like are going to go in there, you're pretty sure are going to wreck the dish, you don't put them in. Right? So as you watch the arising of phenomena in the mind, as you watch these seedlings come out of the seedbed, pretty soon you get pretty good at representing, being able to recognize which ones are wholesome and which ones are unwholesome. And so that's where this notion of right effort comes in. The more we do insight meditation practice, the better able we are to see when something arises in the mind, whether it's a wholesome or an unwholesome thought, a wholesome or an unwholesome emotion. So like Bhante Gunaratana says, you know, what mindfulness does is to slow down the rate of activity in the mind, at the same time it accelerates the rate of attention. So you become better able to see, oh wow, okay, here comes that intention, you know. Unwholesome, kind of like a bubble in a swamp, you know, coming up to the surface and popping and say, ew, that was nasty. But at least when you're able to clearly see what these things for what they are, oftentimes if there is unwholesome intention, some intention to act out of attachment, aversion, or delusion, simply recognizing it for what it is when it arises in the mind is enough to dispel it. And it's at this point, okay, from the two wisdom factors, first right or wise understanding, the second is right or wise intention, right? So you're doing your mindfulness practice and you're seeing these things come up in the mind, thoughts, feelings, reflections, intentions to behave in wholesome or unwholesome ways. And you see them come up, you're able to identify them for what they are. Okay. You're able to identify them in the same ways that you were doing, you know, that Vedana was occurring, you know, as the self is being put together in the first place, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay. So you see an unpleasant intention arise. Okay. And it's kind of like me in the calorie counter. You know, do I eat Rocky Road ice cream or do I eat fruit and yogurt? You know, you're able to look at the arising of the intention and say, okay, if I eat the ice cream, it's going to have one set of effects. If I eat the yogurt and fruit, it's going to have another set of effects. Okay. That's insight into who you are going to be in the next moment of your life. Okay. It's insight into your intentions before you speak or act. And if you can get to the point, you can slow the mind down to where the unwholesome intentions are recognized for what they are and are not acted upon. It's at that point that the cessation of suffering begins to occur. And you act on the wholesome instead, and you start creating positive karma for yourself and others as a result. So that's the nature of the process. And I've been chatting away about it for about a half an hour now, and I'd like the rest of our time to be spent maybe reflecting on it together. If you have any thoughts or questions or reflections, this is their time to share them. Please.
What are the other wisdom factors? You cited the two.
There are two.
Oh, there's just two?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And three meditation factors, effort, concentration, mindfulness, two wisdom factors, right understanding, right intention.
Right.
And then the three kind of virtuous life factors of wise speech, action, and way of life.
And I thought I heard you say some subtext for the first one. It's right or wise understanding your view. And the question, what I thought I heard you say is, who am I at core? Did you say that or no?
Well, when you...
Because then I had a question.
Yeah.
When yourself.
When you have insight into... And basically, right or wise understanding is right or wise understanding not only of yourself and everything that's going on, you know, in your sankharas, but also of everyone else as well. And so it's like universal knowledge at the same time. So when they talk about right view, it's your view of yourself, it's your view of others. It's your view of the entire nature of constant interactivity going on in the world. Buddha once said, the meditator who understands paticca-samuppada understands dependent origination, understands the entirety of the Dharma. Okay, and that's one way of understanding. And so the right understanding. And then it's out of that when you see intentions arise. Based upon your insight, your right understanding, you know, it's like my calorie counter, you know the relationship between intentions and outcomes. Okay. You can see that. And so then as your intentions arise, you can clearly see which ones are going to lead to beneficial result, which ones are not. And then it's another act of volition to not act on the unwholesome, and to act on the wholesome instead, if you act at all.
And just a quick follow-up, just a statement, not so much a question. This question comes out of my Christian Jungian background,
yeah.
The true self, the self you were,
yeah.
God created you to be,
yes.
Versus the self that gets all stuck with expectation,
sure.
Of your own addictions or aversions,
yep.
Or sensory deprivations, etc. It's like, who is this, who is Jim? You know, who am I really? And Richard Rohr talks about it. It's like, he has this little dialogue with God. He says, who am I? Who are you? And I have a tape where he says that over and over about three times. And it's if you sort of listen with the right intention, you sort of get what he's trying to get at there.
Sure.
Who am I?
Yep.
Who are you?
That's a time-honored practice in a lot of wisdom traditions, you know. There's an exercise that is done sometimes in this tradition where you organize yourself into dyads, two people, and for 5 minutes, one person asks the other, who are you? And you give an answer, and then they ask the question again. It's called peeling the onion.
Yes.
You know, we have all these notions, all these identities of who we are, or who we think we are, and you just keep putting them away. And then you come closer and closer to this question of, is there some ineffable, eternal thing that's going on in the middle or not. You know, there's a one of the books written by one of the Thai forest meditation masters, Buddhadasa. It's called Heart Root of the Bodhi Tree. The Bodhi Tree at its core is empty. So what he's getting at there is that what lies at the center of all of this is emptiness, is the void, is not self. All that which we take to be solid and substantial and unchanging, the reason that looks to us as if that is so is because of delusion. And that as we look more and more and more closely, we become more and more aware of the fact that that is so. The relationship between no self and true self is an interesting one. Jack Kornfield's book, The Path with Heart, has a whole chapter titled Self or Not Self or True Self. And what he basically winds up saying in there is that these are tricks of language. That to a remarkable extent, both set of teachings are kind of trying to get at the same thing. You know, in the big book, you know, Bill Wilson talks about, you know, in terms of steps towards self-healing, one of them is, you know, admitting that you're powerless over alcohol, it's taking control of your life, and that in order to heal beyond the state, you have to surrender yourself to a higher power. And that's a fairly theistic construct, although he was really doing everything he possibly could to make this an ecumenical teaching that all could relate to. But the whole idea was he was trying to get at the same thing that Buddha was. The construct of self, the construct of ego, you know, is actually getting in your way. It's actually a big problem. And in order to really heal beyond this constrained sense of self, you have to surrender it. Whether in fact you're surrendering it to a higher power, you know, if one is envisioned, you know, an external entity of some kind. In Buddha Dharma, we talk more about clearing away the obscurations for the arising of one's Buddha nature. You know, that's certainly the language they use in the Mahayana, you know, wisdom and compassion. And in the Theravada, it's a little more spare. It's just once the unwholesome is melted away, then the true nature, you know, the true nature of ourselves unbound, you know, or unconstrained, naturally flows forth. And it's to be trusted. So different words, different constructs even, but underlying it all, I think, is the same intention, which is, you know, freeing yourself. Please.
I was wondering how the Buddha saw the role of person-to-person interacting in that unraveling of the self. I was just thinking when you were talking about the coming to terms with your dietary desires. My ongoing nemesis is my condominium association's home board, and I've been having some pretty troublesome fantasies about, you know, what I thought I needed to do so that they would learn the right thing to do, you know, to do things my way, essentially. But it wasn't until I took a walk with a friend that I saw the insanity of my thinking. You know, and I meditated and I thought carefully and I tried to reflect on my thinking. And it just got warmer. I read it to suit the entire building when I went for a walk. And then when I articulated it, I remember something Freud said once, I think, about when you articulate something out loud, it comes to a higher level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's compatible with anything.
Oh, certainly. That's one of the reasons the Buddha said that Sangha or spiritual community is so important, because you're in that community of others who are working to, you more or less see the world the same way, understand the mind the same way, and when we find ourselves in some kind of difficulty, then we can kind of both understand that each of us is struggling internally with which, you know, intentions arise and whether we act on them or not. When my wife and I were did our very first insight meditation retreat together in 1975. It was up in the Redwoods in Northern California, a little summer camp. And our relationship was at a particularly strained place. And we had each become convinced that the other was the author of all of our sorrows. And that we'd probably be much happier if we weren't necessarily in that person's presence. This was our first time doing a residential retreat like this. It was 2 weeks in silence. And it was with Jack Cornfield, Joseph Polstein, and Sharon Salzberg, the year they all started teaching together. And the teachings we received are the very same ones we talk about in here. Where suffering really comes from. And over the course of the retreat, without us ever having spoken a word to each other, we both kind of realized what was really going on. And by the time the retreat was over, when we got together and compared notes, what we found was that we had a medium of communication that hadn't existed before, that we felt profound compassion, both for our own suffering and that of the other, and realized how much of our speech, our action and whatnot, hadn't caused positive harm to the other. And in reflecting on it, we're both pretty sure that it was that experience that saved our marriage. Because while we had been projecting all of our, you know, difficulties onto the behavior of the other, we realized it was actually coming from within. That we were the ones generating it, and only we could bring it to a halt. And it required common intention on both of our parts to grow through that experience. The asymmetry happens when you're really doing your best and you're interacting with somebody who's on another planet. Just sees things in a very different way, or are deep in the throes of big time dukkha, you know, of anxiety, fear, and anger, and that pretty much entails the totality of their intentions, and they act on them without reflection, constantly. That can be a really tough person to be around, really pushes all your buttons, because it has the effect of us wanting to kind of raise our guard, you know, and respond in the same way. There's a maxim in the martial arts tradition that says, the longer two combatants fight each other, the more alike they become, you know. And so if you're really trying hard to practice the Dharma, instead of mirroring the unwholesome speech and action you see in the other, what you're trying to do is to generate a different kind of example. And sometimes by so doing, gradually the other begins to be affected in the same way, sometimes not. Depends on how saturated they are in their own aversive state of mind. is that helpful? Yeah, okay, good. Please.
The best example I've heard of that is when Thich Nhat Hanh, I think he still does it, he doesn't do it, but the Plum Village community does it. They bring 15 Palestinian young teenagers, mm-hmm. 15 Israeli teenagers mm-hmm. to Plum Village for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, and they do deep silence and deep listening together. Mm-hmm. And then they have some kind of ceremony, and he ships them back, and he brings 15 more. Same thing. And that's just once a year, multiple times a year, but that is a similar kind of example, a practical example of mm-hmm. deep listening and mm-hmm. deep silence.
Yeah. Please, other comment, reflection, questions?
You've talked a little bit about compassion and the heart.
Yes.
And yet, what you've laid out sounds to me like a wisdom tradition that we're following the mind. And can you talk about how the heart informs the mind?
Thank you. Wonderful question, very skillful. At home, discovered that a mouse or two maybe is decided to try setting up housekeeping in our kitchen. And I went around, found all the places where they may have been getting into the kitchen, sealed them up in the wall and everything. I was able to do so successfully, with the exception of one little place that looks like we'd have to move the stove to get at. And so we're still puzzling what to do with that. It's a situation that Magnolia the cat finds to be completely unacceptable. And so her way of dealing with this is that there's a little place, you know, between the cabinet and the stove where the mouse kind of sticks its head out every now and then and kind of looks around a little bit. And so Magnolia has positioned herself just off to the side of this space where she can't be seen. And I've, you know, going in and out of the kitchen, you know, during the day or the evening, I've seen her crouching there absolutely still with her gaze intently focused on the space for like 10 or 15 minutes at a time, you know. And one way or another, you know, she very much wants to play a game of lopsided tag with this mouse, you know. And I've been very impressed with her level of concentration, driven by this intention, you know. It's just like so focused. And that kind of vigilance is actually something that Buddha recommended, you know, when you can develop it. You know, the more closely you're able to watch what's going on in the mind, the more likely you are to be able to free yourself of the unwholesome. And how that relates to your question is this. When we achieve, when we find ourselves living nonstop in the state of not-self, okay, we don't have to worry about volition anymore. Wholesome, unwholesome, because volition is about, in one way or another, about the intention to sort of conjure the self. And so the insight practices, the wisdom part, is about developing the capacity, like Magnolia, to quickly see the wholesome and the unwholesome as they arise. And the sooner you find them, the easier it is to disempower the unwholesome. In terms of volition, what we know from our experience in terms of the wisdom factors is that when we, you know, like the Buddha said, you know, speak or act based on unwholesome intention, and sorrow will follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen and the god. So right effort in this instance consists of not cultivating the unwholesome, because we know it leads to suffering. What, when you find, you know, when you're reflecting and you see that, wow, I've really behaved unskillfully here, caused harm to myself and others, you experience suffering, you experience dukkha, you experience unsatisfactoriness. The experience of that combined with insight naturally gives rise to feelings of compassion. It's possible to use volition to cultivate, to bring forth the wholesome. Okay. So the way Suzuki Roshi would talk about this, he talked about what he called mind weeds, and he's using the image of the alaya, the seed consciousness, right? And so these plants germinate, and you see something come up, and you know it's a weed. Okay, what you do is uproot it. And in their gardening, you know, they shake it of its seeds, and then they chop it up and they work it back into the soil as mulch. Right? And then when you see the things you want to grow, your food plants coming up, you nourish them and you cultivate them, you water them and whatnot. The way you do that with regard to wise intention, beneficial volition, is you cultivate the arising wholesome states of mind. That is exactly what the practice of loving kindness is about. So when you're, you know, doing phrases of metta phrases, you know, may I live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May I and others live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May I be free of all physical and mental suffering. May I experience my inner joy and share it with others. May I rest in silence and stillness and experience inner peace. May I rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. That's the cultivation of the wholesome. And little bit by little bit, that becomes the guidance system rather than the ego, okay? Instead, you're coming to become more trustful of the arising of the wholesome in your mind. Okay. That becomes more and more possible the more and more you practice. The better and better we get at seeing the arising of the unwholesome and doing nothing about it, seeing the arising of the wholesome and cultivating it. That's how this kind of personal transformation begins to take place. And that's where we start to lose our fear of letting go of the self and trusting this other way of living that is coming from a different root source, it's coming from a different place within. Okay, good. Please.
It seems like a bit of a silly question.
No silly questions in the Dharma. There's some silly answers, but
I've seen some people sort of take this idea of no self or whatever to like a blog or something or other where they say that when you are enlightened, Glenn no longer exists. You know, like somehow in my mind, they've taken it literally when there's a,
I'm not altogether sure what you're saying.
Well, like people aren't real.
Okay.
You know, it's almost like you're saying that. Therefore, you know, it's almost like they're taking it literally in some way instead of the more maybe I don't know philosophical is the right way.
Yep.
The right term.
Yep. I think I understand what you're saying. One of the, when you hear somebody, well, it's interesting, but is it art? One of the things that, one of the definitional characteristics of whether or not something is art is whether it's susceptible to multiple levels of understanding, of interpretation, right? And oftentimes what's talked about in the Dharma is what's called provisional truths and ultimate truths. Okay. Like Ram Dass used to say, you know, it's great to become one with the mind of God, but don't forget your zip code. It's important to be able to stay rooted in the world of appearances and things. At the same time, your mind is capable of apprehending a reality in which those things don't obtain. You know, it's like Newtonian physics versus particle physics versus string theory. You know, there are all different ways of trying to understand aspects of the world of matter and energy, and they all have their own realms of applicability. And that's somewhat the kind of thing we're talking about here. Where it gets really unskillful is when people get these confused, and they start thinking, okay, well, there's no self. Well, you know, then you can say, do think anything you want, you know, behave any way you want to. There was a, back when I was in the 1970s, when we were kind of checking out kind of whatever kind of sort of, or looking into inquiring whatever kind of, you know, spiritual line of inquiry that came along. We spent some time with this outfit called Eureka Institute in San Francisco, and they were of the view that they had transcended conventional morality and whatnot, some of them. And so some of them had a business in which you would tell them what it was you wanted and they'd steal it for you for 25% of retail. And that included furniture from Macy's, you know. They would put on, you know, moving company outfits, pull the truck out to the back, you know, put some on the dolly and haul it out. That kind of went awry after a while, you know, after they got busted. They got kind of drawn back down into the conventional reality of things. So essentially, when people kind of get into that territory, it's because of a completely incomplete understanding of the nature of karma. You know, that even if you are of the view that there's no self and it doesn't matter what you do or say, it does. You know, because your thoughts, I know your speech and your actions and whatnot, it is like planting more seeds that are going to come to fruition. And that way, you know, the Buddha and Jesus of Nazareth had very similar teachings. You know, you shall know them by your fruits. You know, there, and the Buddha told this to the young student Subha, you know, and he asked which spiritual path he should follow. And he said, look to the effects of the teachings on those who practice them, okay, including the teachers. And there lies your answer in terms of what is a skillful path to follow. And we followed ourselves right up to the 8 o'clock hour. So it's time for us to, once again, if you would be so kind for just a moment, to take your sitting posture and allow the eyes to gently close. The attention to come to rest on the breathing. May we live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May we know and share our inner joy. May we rest in silence and stillness and know inner peace. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free.